My Black Counts is a podcast series produced by the Center for Community Engagement, Environmental Justice, and Health, with assistance from WYPR.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to My Block Counts, an environmental justice podcast dedicated to helping people know so they can grow and help things flow within their communities. My name is Dr. Jacoby Wilson, and today's episode, we're going to talk about important issues around environmental justice. We're going to talk about the upcoming 10th Seed Symposium, past, present, and future. So our final guest of this podcast is Michael Payan with the Success Health Environmental Network, SHIN, and San Jose Eastern Shore Health, SESH. Michael is the SESH director. So for over a decade, you know, we've been working with Mike and Maria during that time as community organizers, fighting against industrial chicken farming in the Delmarva region, fighting for environmental justice and health for those who are most impacted by those operations in the Delmarva. This is including performing research in air quality and water quality impacts in Delaware and the Eastern Shore of Maryland. SESH has worked closely with SEED to perform health impact assessments, using GIS to assess differential burdens in industrial chicken farming, providing training and workshops to impacted residents, and also providing technical assistance on zoning, planning issues, and administrative complaints. In addition to this work, we've been really just collaborating for over a decade to really help empower the residents who are impacted by industrial chicken farming, but also workers who've been impacted occupationally, who work in processing plants. So I want to welcome Michael to the stage. Hey, Michael, say hi to the audience.
Hi, everybody. My name is Michael Payan. Dr. Wilson, thank you so much for having me on the podcast today.
So, Michael, let's talk about these unique challenges that we see in the Eastern Shore in Southern Delaware. We have agricultural runoff. We have emissions from the chicken farms. Can you talk about your work and how y'all are trying to address these issues, which are at the intersection of agriculture and public health?
Of course. So, you know, here on the Eastern Shore of Maryland and, you know, Southern Delaware, on the Delmarva Peninsula, you know, we deal with a lot of industrial poultry. It's at a very high scale here. It's very dense. There's often, you know, almost a million birds on one site being raised at one time in some of these sites. You know, a lot of animals come with a lot of waste, and that leads to problems within a community. You know, one of the number one things you think about when, you know, farmers are thinking about managing land, managing their livestock, you never have more animals than your land can handle. And that's exactly what we see going on here on the Eastern Shore. So, you know, we're on a very sandy geology here by the coast. You know, when we have all these animals and all that waste needs to be applied to fields. When there's not proper amount of uptake from the crops that are on the fields, what's left, it runs off the fields into our waterways. It soaks into the ground, has that sandy geology, contaminates people's water around here. Same with the air. We got fans that are putting out levels of ammonia. We got piles of waste that are putting off particulate matter, putting off other pollutants that people are dealing with, breathing it in on a daily basis. You know, it's tough out here because it's a rural context. You know, a lot of the neighbors feel that, you know, they don't want to speak against their neighbor when they see something going on. When they have a complaint, and there's often a lot of control from the industries in these areas, right? They give to the Boy Scouts, they give to the food banks, they give to the baseball teams. And so they have a lot of clout, a lot of power within the community, and they use that to take advantage of some of these communities. So people feel like they're very restricted in what they can and cannot do in public against these industries. Recently, we've been able to get a breakthrough with a lot of the air monitoring efforts we have going on. We've been very excited about that because for decades we've had, you know, legislators, representatives tell us we can't do anything about your concerns because they're not validated by data. we don't have data to support these things. We can't regulate these industries without data that shows that your concerns are valid. And they kick this can down the road saying, no, we don't have the information. We don't have the information. We need to get the information. So finally, you know, through community science, we've been able to start getting some of that important information that we need for people to start opening their eyes, paying attention, regulating these issues. A couple of years ago down here, MDE and the Campbell Foundation had come up with a white paper talking about some of the emissions that communities were concerned about, you know, and you know, what we would consider the frontline residents, the communities that should have been a part of the decision-making as to how that was conducted, where those sites were, what, you know, how they were doing these measurements. Those folks weren't involved in that decision-making process. When this white paper came out, the conclusion was basically that they needed more information, but there was no problem with any ammonia emissions that they were seeing, right? And when you look at the sites that they picked, right, I talked about sometimes you can find a million birds on site in one site, or hundreds of chicken barns within a square mile radius. You know, these folks were picking places where there was 2.5 chicken barns per square mile. You know, places that half a chicken barn per square mile, places where the density was nowhere near what the residents that are complaining about the health issues, complaining about quality of life issues are dealing with. When we're doing measurements at the real front line, some of our preliminary data is showing like 100 times the amount of ammonia that these folks were finding when they were doing that industry-led study. So what does that tell you, right? So now that we're getting some of that information, we're getting the eyes open, and you know, there's some really exciting things going on in the background that we hope will lead to some meaningful progress.
Thank you for that, Michael. So this thing about what Michael just said, y'all. So you're doing a scientific study, and supposedly they said, well, part of the rationale for that, they had a rationale for picking those locations, right? Get more background levels. But if communities are complaining about exposures and health impacts, you need to go where the communities are what? Complaining about exposure to impact and health impacts. So you need to go where there's a clustering or a density of more operations than animals to look at the spatial temporal variation of the pollutants of concern, right? So I don't want to take this interview over, Michael, because you know, I did my dissertation on hog farms, but it makes no sense. It makes no scientific sense to do a study like that where you're really not trying to really understand exposures and those health impacts. So I just want to co-sign on what you just said. And this is the reason why, again, for the audience, we need community science, a community-driven science, because as you heard as a theme of this podcast, the folks who are dealing with the issues know best. They're the contextual experts, right? So the community science is the way to make sure we're getting the most rigorous science done to understand the problems, to get the real solutions. So let's go to this next question, Michael. I'm getting a little excited here. So let me give you this next question. When you think about these issues, you know, and you're trying to organize and mobilize rural communities, it says it's a sensitive issue in rural communities because of the economics, right? These communities may be disconnected from the mainstream environmental movements. So can you share a success story from your work in organizing and mobilizing communities in the rural context?
I mean, absolutely. I would say, you know, maybe a recent example is, you know, with the poultry workers, right? I mean, these are folks that are definitely the poster children of the industry's power in our area, because they are, to the industry, I mean, the way they're treated, it seems as if they're replaceable, right? They're a number within the system. They're at work losing limbs before they get their first paycheck. They're getting acid burns down their arms that the companies, you know, are sending them to physical therapy for. I don't know what that's about, trying to keep injury reports out or something. But, you know, these people are really dealing with the brunt of these issues. And they feel very powerless in the sense that, you know, that some of their immigration, their citizenship status may be questionable. They may be here on a program. They may not be. They have very little power when it comes to some of the things that are going on that they're experiencing at work. You know, from having continuous meetings with these workers, you know, they're exposed to this at work. Those same farms are set up in their community, so they're dealing with the issues at work, dealing with the issues at home. After you're engaging with them in a meaningful way, they're willing to speak up, talk about the issues they're experiencing with you, and we're able to go out and find resources that may be able to further their issues at work, right? It might be connecting them with somebody who can connect them with the right person at OSHA to talk to report what's going on. It may be, you know, connecting them with other immigrant worker resources where they're able to, you know, be able to, you know, advocate for rights in the workplace in an effective way while still keeping their job safe. That's one of the big projects we have going on right now is trying to help these folks to be able to advocate for just basic training in their languages before they're stepping on floors with dangerous equipment, with dangerous chemicals, just be able to explain to them how they can do that safely so they can bring a paycheck home to their family and survive. I would say that's a recent success of ours is really getting some meaningful engagement with those communities, getting them into regular meetings so that we can start to push for some of these initiatives that they want to see in the workplace for their safety. You know, and it's little wins. Sometimes it's just little wins that mean a lot. You know, recently we had the biogas plant in Seaford, Delaware. They're trying to bring waste in, poultry processing waste from the region, from Maryland, Delaware, Pennsylvania, tri-state region here, Virginia, I believe as well, turn it into like natural gas in our communities, right? And this was a limited English proficiency community. Many of the folks speaking English as a second language. They were not given proper public notice of this coming into their community, didn't really get a chance to meaningfully participate, review the information in their own language about this facility that was proposed for their community, didn't get a meeting space that was friendly to the community, particularly those that are from that limited English proficiency community. They have spaces where they're comfortable to meet, again, citizenship status, other things that may make it complicated for them to come into a government building, participate like some other folks might. You know, they weren't able to participate. We were able to file a Title VI that was accepted by the EPA, and they're looking into these issues. And as a result of that, DENRAC, who puts out the notices for similar projects like this, has started putting those notices out in Haitian Creole and Spanish when the community needs it, right? When it's a community that has that limited English proficiency within it. And you know, that's a small win. And they got an EJ coordinator too. And those are small wins, but they're meaningful. You know, they didn't shut this facility down. It's still getting, you know, it doesn't look like it's not going to get sited there at this point, but it means a lot that in the future there will be an opportunity to meaningfully participate. Just a couple examples there.
Yo, no, thank you for that. No, the small wins add up. I mean, that's everyone listening. Environmental justice, you know, being in any movement, it's a struggle, it's a fight. And so we have to, you know, bend that arc towards justice. It's a struggle, right? And I think as you spoke to, I mean, some of those, you know, sensitivities when it comes to folks who are working in these spaces, right? Who may have language barriers, who may have, you know, some citizenship issues that create additional barriers, right? And how you navigate. So thank you for that response. You know, have you had success working with local government regulatory agencies to address these health concerns, some that you already outlined? Can you speak to those issues?
What it seems like is that people are restricted within their positions from maybe taking some of the meaningful actions that they would like to when they're in like a state regulatory agency. You know, DENREC, when we engage with them.
Tell the audience what DIDREC is.
But DENREC is Department of Natural Resource and Environmental Controls in Delaware. They're the environmental regulator, supposed to keep industries in check from, you know, getting out of control, managing the permits and stuff that are issued to these industries that we're referring to here. The head of that is appointed by our governor, who is elected. It seems like folks that are running these agencies are restricted in the sense that they're not willing to maybe violate some of these folks that are viewed as economic growth providers in our area, right? They don't want to make it hard for anybody to do business generally, right? And that means violating them. That means calling them out when they're doing wrong. That means, you know, really being strict about what kind of permits are being approved and where. Right. So that's half of it. But, you know, the enforcement side isn't there either. Once this facility's there and it's causing problems and you're calling them about it, trying to get them to come out, even take a look at a site. I mean, we have issues getting people to show up. And then even if we collect the evidence ourselves for a particular violation, you know, you'll get people. Oh, well, that's a picture. It's not a video. That's not enough to really tell what's going on. Just not a willingness to help out. It's more of a, it seems like they're there to defend these economic growth providers in our area rather than protect communities and protect the environment, which is what their mission is supposed to be. Again, little wins, right? DENREC has an EJ coordinator now, Dr. Moore, Dr. Katira Moore, who has been just a pleasure to work with on the side, you know, and to have, you know, her having in conversation with us, trying to move some of our issues forward through the past that she's aware of that we may not be. In terms of getting people clean water, especially. But, you know, she's getting frustrated because she's running into a lot of barriers as well within the system. And, you know, she's looking at you know, you mentioned my mom a little earlier in the podcast, Maria Payan. But, you know, she's been working on this for the past 12 years, You know, she got the EJ coordinator got there a year ago. She's like, I've been working this for 12 months. I can't believe it. I can't get anything done. People don't want to listen. She's like, you know, we're not crazy. I mean, this is what it is down here. So, but again, like, how do you move that? How do you change that? Like the data, right? Because once you can start presenting data that's like, you can't deny what's going on here in these communities, it just hasn't been done. There's been a gap that science hasn't been completed yet, or it's starting to get completed. We have little pieces of it. That's how you can bring that to a regulator, you can bring that to a representative, whatever it may be, and they're almost forced to listen to you because you have it in black and white. And that's what we're getting to.
That's an important point for the audience. So, a big part of this work in the environmental justice space is environmental justice science. And I mentioned the term community science before. Communities are being forced to collect their own data because, as Michael said, in some cases, the agencies may do the politics, pollution politics, the economics in their state, and who's in power and the leadership and some of those pressures. May be less apt, may be less interested, may not be equipped to push back to fight, particularly if in the mission of that agency is public health, protecting the environment. It's in your mission, but you can't complete your mission because of politics. So communities have to do the science for the agencies. So community science, as I said earlier, folks are trying to do community science, community-driven science. They're doing the best research, getting the best questions, the best data. You know what? Because people are surviving. They want to stop being poor. So they want to move from surviving to thriving. And that's why, as Michael just said, you're doing ground truthing, anecdotally. Oh, that's anecdotal information. Well, you got anecdotal evidence. I'm going to give you some real data. So this work is important. And at the symposium, we're going to have a lot of sessions about community science. We're going to have a lot of sessions highlighting air quality monitoring that community folks are doing across the Mid-Atlantic to solve these challenging problems, like the ones that Michael has described, that the communities that they're serving in the Eastern Shore and in Southern Delaware, as it relates to the whole entrenchment of the industrial chicken farm industry in that region. So Michael, let's go to this question more about the symposium. So you got a session that's upcoming about agriculture, CAFOs, and for the audience, CAFOs is an acronym that's concentrated animal feeding operations, or it could be also confined animal feeding operations, or yeah, those are the two. And then biogas. And when you talk about biogas, this session, so what is the session about? Agriculture, CAFOs, and biogas facilities. What are biogas facilities? Give the audience a little bit more information about your session.
Of course. So let's start off with what this biogas facility is. What is this? So biogas is taking, waste, chicken waste, as well as poultry processing waste or any type of waste. It doesn't have to be chicken or chicken processing. Basically creating natural gas from it through an anaerobic digester. And, I think explaining that process of anaerobic digestion a little bit above me, but the point is it's making natural gas out of waste. This is being incentivized in many areas as a green form of energy to be creating gas out of waste. And that's not how our community feels for sure. Often these facilities are being incentivized by government programs, subsidies for that green energy. They're considering them to be. So that is definitely one of our frustrations with it. You'll probably hear some of that at the symposium session. We do have some folks there that we are going to be speaking with. One of them is Dr. Chris Heaney at Johns Hopkins University, who has done a tremendous amount of work on the ground here, helping us to collect some of this community science data that we've talked about has been so important in the past few minutes. He has helped us to collect near the proposed site of the biogas facility, as well as a lot of areas where we've had citizen complaints about the density of the CAFOs and the air quality issues they're experiencing as a result of that. Rebecca Wolf's going to be there from Food and Water Watch, who works on some of the policy issues around CAFOs, around industrial agriculture. My mother, who we've mentioned a couple times, Maria Payan as well, who's been working on these issues, and Dr. Deanne Williams from JHU as well, from Center for a Livable Future. So definitely come and check it out. We're going to be talking about a lot of these issues in detail, what these communities are dealing with, how this affects people's quality of life, and what we can hopefully do to move the ball forward on some of those issues.
Thank you, Michael. Really appreciate the time today. Again, so Michael Payen, well, he didn't mention it, but Michael's been doing this work for a long time. And again, when we think about EJ work, folks are in the movement, the folks that are driving the movement, people have been impacted, and he's been impacted by this industry on his health. His family's been impacted, right? So really appreciate your time talking about very important environmental justice issues. In many cases, when we think about environmental justice, we tend to focus more on urban areas or suburban areas, but listen, audience, there are a lot of environmental justice issues in rural communities. So Michael talked about issues around agriculture, right? We got issues around people who don't have access to sewer and water, who don't have access to safe potable water, and folks that in his community he's working with, that folks have been impacted by industrial chicken farmers, whether it be exposures from the gases, but also working at the chicken processing plant, but then also having runoff issues and stuff impacting their water quality, right? So you got rural communities across this country who are impacted by environmental justice issues. And he talked about this biogas issue, right? You got rural communities who are impacted by, you know, think about the energy, dirty fossil fuel infrastructure or energy infrastructure in general. You're trying to make gas. You're trying to make fuel from animal waste. He said it already, y'all. Is that really green? You're transforming animal poo into energy? For some of y'all, oh, that sounds a great idea. But it's not a great idea if you live in that community. If you want to get rid of those chicken waste piles, if you want to stop those chicken waste piles from being blown into your home, and you got chicken fecal material in your house, on your bed, on top of your stove, right? In your children's bed, in your bathroom. You want to have that stuff been blown into your garden. You want to have that stuff been blown into your well water. You wouldn't want that. So no, that's not a great idea. It's not sustainable. It's not the right type of farming. We want to support, we support farming, y'all. We support agriculture. Where we support sustainable agriculture, regenerative agriculture, family farming, y'all. Just want to leave on that note. Just make sure that y'all not hearing Michael say he doesn't support rural life, right? And part of the rural life is agriculture. We support sustainable agriculture, right, Michael?
That's right.
Thank you again, sir, for your time. Really appreciate, you know, you and your mother's partnership in this fight for environmental justice, and really looking forward to your symposium session on, you know, agriculture issues, you know, industrial chicken farming and biogas, and who's getting justice when it comes to those impacts in rural areas. Thank you again, Michael.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson. It's a pleasure. And, you know, we want to thank you for everything you've done, not just to put together the symposium, but really everything you've contributed to the EJ movement. You know, all of us that are working in the frontline communities that you've chosen to engage with, we really, really appreciate you.
Yeah, thank you, sir. So we just had three great guests. Wakira from Central de Apoyo Familia, Queen Shabazz with United Parents Against Lead, UPAL, and Michael Payen with Sensley Eastern Shore Health and Success Environmental Health Network, talking about their work as EJ advocates, fighting for justice for communities, you know, who've been poisoned, y'all. I mean, I talked about toxic trauma. I didn't bring this term up earlier, but folks have been basically sacrificed for economic gains. I mean, living in sacrifice zones. So the EJ movement is about, it's a struggle, right? But moving folks, as my frat brother, Mustafa Santiago Lee would say, moving from surviving to thriving. And a symposium that's been highlighted on this podcast has been a very important infrastructure, a very important venue, a very important space to bring people together over a decade. This is our 10th symposium. We can call it the 10th anniversary, but symposium has been around for over a decade. And so we really want to make sure that listeners out there, that you're able to participate. If you're interested in the environmental justice movement, if you're interested in being a good ally, showing good allyship, you should attend a symposium. If you are a frontline, fenceline community member, right, who's experiencing environmental justice issues, climate, energy justice issues, food justice issues, y'all, housing justice, transportation justice, water justice, social injustice, economic injustice, racial injustice, please attend the symposium. We have virtual options and also in-person options. Symposium is September 11th through the 14th. The theme, again, is about past, present, and future of the EJ movement. If you're not part of the EJ movement, you can be part of the future of the EJ movement, y'all. If you want to register for the symposium, please go to www.ceej.center. It is free, everybody. That's free with a capital F-R-E-E. Wednesday, September 11th is virtual day. So it's going to be all remote. Thursday to Saturday are our hybrid days. So for those of you who need support, who are looking to access federal dollars from the Inflation Reduction Act or the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, if you're interested in the EPA Community Change Grant, if you're interested in funding through the Grantmakers Program, if you're interested in funding from the Solar for All Program, if you're interested in learning more about the Climate Pollution Prevention Grants, if you're interested in any federal grant that you want to apply for, whether it be from EPA, Department of Energy, et cetera, please come to the symposium. We're going to have multiple sessions on how to apply for federal funding. We're going to have technical assistance providers who can coach you, provide you with consultation to be able to access these federal opportunities like the Environmental Finance Center. If you want to learn about workforce development, if you want to receive scientific technical assistance, like deeper scientific technical assistance, we'll have folks from the CHARM Center, which is the NIH-funded center based at Johns Hopkins University. If you want to meet and build relationships, partnerships with clean energy providers, we will have a number of clean energy providers who will be exhibitors for our symposium. So again, Thursday to Saturday, yes, we have a hybrid option. You can participate virtually. If you want to get technical assistance, capacity build support, and consultation, it's important for you to register to join us in person. So hopefully we'll see you at the symposium of our 10th one. It's been really great over a decade of having this very exciting event. There's going to be 75 plus sessions at the symposium related to the Mid-Atlantic Climate Action Hub and also related to the US EPA Region 3 Thriving Communities Technical Assistance Center. So that acronym is TCTAC, TICTAC. We're going to have about 200 sessions in total across those 4 days, again, September 11th through the 14th. And we'll have sessions on air quality monitoring, community science. We're going to have sessions on what's going on in D.C. and Virginia and New Jersey around environmental justice. We're going to have sessions of international EJ sessions. We're going to have sessions that focus on food justice. We're going to have sessions that focus on indigenous rights and indigenous issues. We're going to have sessions that focus on human rights and Latinx populations. We're going to have a number of sessions that really help people learn how to use mapping tools. You know, what we call GIS, Geographic Information Systems Mapping Tools. If you want to learn about what's happening in West Virginia, we'll have a session on that. If you want to learn about what's happening in Pittsburgh, we'll have a session on Pittsburgh. If you want to learn about EJ issues in Philadelphia, in Metro Philadelphia, we'll have a session there. If you want to learn about what's happening in Newark, New Jersey, we'll have a session there. If you want to learn about what you can do to, again, empower yourself, empowerment science, and how you liberate yourself from pollution, we'll have sessions. So we have sessions across the board for folks from frontline fence communities. We have sessions that focus on youth. If you're from academia, this is an event from you. We're also going to have a lot of sessions related to government policies and regulations. So the symposium, again, has had a huge impact in Maryland, has a huge impact on the EJ movement and the DMV. It's had a huge impact on the EJ movement in the Mid-Atlantic. Please join us. Again, you can go to www.ceej.center to register. This is, again, Dr. Jacoby Wilson with the Health, Economic, and Environmental Justice Lab, the EJ Lab, and also with SEEJ, the Center for Community Engagement, Environmental and Health. This is My Block Counts, an environmental justice podcast dedicated to helping people know so they can grow and help things flow in their communities. Come on, y'all, attend that symposium. If you want to get to know so you can grow and help these flowing communities, you got to attend this 10th anniversary symposium. Thank you again for joining us. And thank you once again to our guests today, Wakaria Poole, Queen Shabazz, and Michael Payan. We thank you for your contributions. Thank all of our hub partners for all their great work. See you next time. Dr. Wilson out.
You've been listening to My Block Counts. My Block Counts is sponsored by the Center for Community Engagement, Environmental Justice, and Health at the University of Maryland. Executive producer and host, Dr. Sakobi Wilson, with production assistance from Ariel Wharton. Technical producer, Kelly Avent. Additional information about My Block Counts can be found at ceej.center or wypr.org. New episodes of My Block Counts are released each month. Please share and subscribe wherever you get your podcast and leave us a review.